Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, and I'm joined by today's co-host, Kristen Polacy. Welcome, Kristen. You became a mother this year.
Yes.
And you're just about finished with your chiropractic training at the University of Southern California Health Sciences. And you've taken a strong interest in pre- and postnatal care.
I have.
And it's now you've been on the podcast before.
Yes.
And you're a phenomenal host. And
thank you.
You're a great book reviewer. So
thanks.
That brings me to the next thing. Our guest in the studio today has taken a long and interesting journey to becoming a published author. She recently completed a memoir titled Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After a Cesarean. She flew in today from Northern California, where she lives with her husband and two children. Thais Nye Derrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Really nice to meet you. Writing a book's not simple.
Agreed.
It's people say it's sort of like having a baby. We made documentaries, which I also sort of felt was like having a baby, or as close as I can come to that. So already with nothing else, knowing nothing else about you, but knowing that you wrote a book and then also that it's popular and a great book, means you've accomplished a lot. But this is not where you started.
That's right, yeah.
You did not start thinking, I want to become a book writer. Right? What did you study originally?
So I studied recreation administration, which is basically going in to run a hotel or be in the park service or...
Parks and Recreation.
Yeah, exactly.
So with a minor in French.
With a minor in French.
Which is I'm fluent in French.
Oh, bonjour.
Oh, no, just breakfast foods.
Oh. Yeah.
Croissant. Brioche. Yeah.
I was trying to tell my son the other day that it's not Le Croix, it's La Croix for the sparkling water.
Oh, really? It's not La Croix?
Yeah.
Cute.
How is it really?
La Croix.
Oh, it sounds better that way.
Oh.
It sounds almost like refreshing when you say it that way.
Yeah, probably like it's supposed to sound.
So you studied Parks and Rec and some French with the mission of going into the hotel industry? Or?
Yeah, so I had kind of a childhood dream of owning a bed and breakfast on the coast, and that never happened.
That's nice, though. I can go there.
I know. I still dream about it. What ended up happening was I spent a lot of time abroad learning French, and I ended up in my last year of college being like, what am I going to do? And spending a lot of time in Paris, I was like, okay, I think I want to work in museums, and that kind of fits what I studied. So nonprofit industry. And then I also, that's when the tech boom was happening. So I got a technical writing certification. And so that's sort of like a minor. So I left, worked at the Exploratorium, and then quit and started doing my technical writing at Cisco and then Macromedia and then Adobe about Macromedia. And so on and
it
so forth.
It sounds way different than a bed and breakfast on the coast.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
A little more stressful.
Yeah, I think that's what happens. You know, you live in San Francisco and everybody's at the bars talking about how much money they're making. And you're just like, okay, I guess I should probably get in this industry. And luckily, I was smart enough to have, you know, a technical writing certification to get myself in there. But now I'm not even doing that. So... life always changes, you know. I think about life as decade by decade. You can always change and do something different.
Well, that seems interesting. I want to, like, make my decade chart.
Yes, that'd be interesting.
When did you move out of that industry?
So that was the first child. So I was working at Adobe. Great job. I biked to work. My husband also was biking to work. We had a beautiful flat in San Francisco. And I'll tell you about my birth later. But in terms of the job, after the birth, I was so traumatized. I couldn't hold down a job. So PTSD style. And I had some bad luck with childcare, and that just did me in. And so we said, oh, let's try, like, see if we can afford you not working. And I've been basically now contracting in different ways for 10 years, you know?
I mean, just the small time I've gotten to know you, you don't sound like a not working type.
No, I'm not. I'm always working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're always working. You just like always, you look like you're always looking for the, you have your finger on the pulse and what you want to do next.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I don't know. I'm always wanting to do something, keep busy. And right now it's the book, and I'm going to learn to be like a keynote speaker so I can get this message across to more people. And so I'm training to do that. And so hopefully I'll be more on the road and just speaking about this issue because it's so important to me and I think to
This is the keynote speaker decade.
Yeah.
It is the keynote
speaker. It's like she's making a consolation and like following her.
Yeah.
I want to learn this.
Ryan's Bell.
Yeah. So I had like a little less than a decade writing the book, and now it's kind of the book promotion. But for me, it's less about being I'm on an author tour where you go to bookstores and you do a reading. And my favorite part is talking about the issues, you know, and what's going on in the birth world. And sometimes people are like, oh, I thought this was a book reading.
well, let's go back to the beginning. You when you had your first baby,
yeah.
You know, you were not involved in the birth community at all.
Not at all. I was your typical mainstream mama.
Were you planning to have a kid or just kind of fell on?
Yeah, no, I definitely, I had a huge drive to have children. And I know it was a huge drive because I do not want any more kids right now at all. Mm. So whenever people say, I want to have a kid, I'm like, you should have a kid then. Because when you don't want to have a kid, you don't want to have a kid.
You really don't. Yeah.
Then it's like past.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it started because you were ready to have kids.
I was ready to have kids, yeah.
And so you got pregnant.
Yep.
And how was your pregnancy?
Pregnancy was great. I was super happy, healthy. No issues at all.
Eat well, exercise.
You
drink the green stuff?
Green juice?
Yeah.
I don't know I was green juicing during pregnancy.
You don't know? yoga? I'm trying to get a sense.
Me back then, what I was doing? Huh. I think I did do yoga at the time. I was a big tennis player, but I probably wasn't playing tennis while I was pregnant.
I played tennis twice and both both
it's
times.
It's so hard.
Well, one time the first time I ever played tennis, I got whacked in the face with a tennis racket and broke a tooth.
Oh.
In camp. It was in summer camp, and I remember because you only had pizza day once a week, and it was pizza day, but I couldn't eat it because I had a nerve dangling out of my face. So I thought I'd never go again. And then the second time, I was in chiropractic school, actually, and one of my car buddies was like, hey, we should go play tennis, because I was looking for interesting ways to work out. And he's like, tennis is fun. You don't even realize you're exercising, which is a load of anyway. So I'd never really hit a tennis ball before. I'd only been hit by a tennis racket, so I know how the ball feels. And he's like, let me serve you something, and you'll hit him back to me. So I played baseball. So he lobbed over a serve, and I hit it like a baseball. It went over the giant fence and then went down on the road where it hit a car in the windshield, and he slammed on his brakes and came this close to getting rear-ended. So I ran away and took the message from the universe, tennis is not my thing.
Yeah. Wow.
But you were playing tennis, which is good, because somebody
really
has to.
Unfortunate events.
Yeah. Were you a tennis player before you got pregnant?
Yeah. I played competitively girls 18 and under.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, Northern California. Yeah. Top 10.
Did it feel different pregnant?
Playing tennis? Yeah. It hurt. Just the twisting and stuff was not.
What about the baby running around with you? Is that? Did you feel like the baby was playing too? Doubles? No?
No, it wasn't getting any extra.
Extra boom.
No.
Yeah.
If you play with one other pregnant woman, you're playing doubles.
Yeah,
that's right. True.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on. I just got hooked on tennis.
Tennis is addicting.
Were you working at the time?
Yeah, I was working.
Tech writing?
Tech writing, yep.
And so during your pregnancy, you feel good. You're active, you're healthy, you feel good. What are you doing to get ready for birth?
Not much. I'm just doing the OB visits, so pee in the cup, 5 minutes.
Measure your belly?
They must
measure your belly, yeah.
They have to.
I can't remember.
That's the one thing they do.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
You pee in the cup, they measure your belly.
Right.
But then you... hold on a second. So you were planning to have an obstetrician birth at a hospital?
Yes, and I chose my obstetrician by... She was on the cover of 7x7 magazine, which is kind of the San Francisco hip magazine.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, she must be great.
Yeah, she must be great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the equivalent of that here? Do we have one of those?
I don't think so. I don't think we do.
I think my wife chose hers from Cosmo.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. That's not true at all.
I think you just have to kind of look it up and hope for the best.
Well, I figured everybody was the same. I didn't realize that there was going to be a difference. I thought that everybody would just practice evidence-based birth and I would get the best birth out there because I lived in San Francisco and I was educated woman. I was going to, you know, state-of-the-art hospital, and why shouldn't everything be how it should be?
Well,
so,
I mean... A lot of women are afraid of childbirth during pregnancy. Did you have fears about it? Were you talking to other women about it? Or
no, I mean, I was actually really wanting a natural birth. I knew I could do it.
What is natural? Because it's such a
hot
term.
Me at the time, it was a vaginal birth with no drugs.
Oh, natural.
Yeah, natural. Like, really natural.
Or the natural. Is that French?
Yes.
No.
I don't think so.
This is Target. It's not really French.
Yeah, we needed them.
So
why did you want that?
I have no idea. I think I just knew I could do it. You know, I was an athlete and felt healthy and wanted to just experience it without really knowing. I didn't really overthink it.
But, I mean, haven't you ever seen movies of women or TV, like where they're screaming their heads off, biting their husbands, you know?
Yeah, you know, I didn't buy into that.
It didn't have an impact on you. You just thought you wrote it off as just TV drama?
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, I did.
Did you have friends who had kids? Or are you the first in your pack?
Yeah, I was one of the first. I had a friend who had her kids. She had them naturally. My sister had 2 C-sections.
Okay, so... When you got closer, were you doing any classes or reading any books?
Oh, yeah. I did take a birth class. And this, the one thing I remember about this birth class was whatever happens, do what the doctor says. Don't be a hero.
Oh.
She just...
Was it a hospital birth class by chance?
Okay.
So basically how to be a good patient.
Yes. She drilled it in us to just be quiet.
I have to say there are some, I think around here there are some really interestingly good hospital birth classes now. They're evolving over time.
Yeah.
But they still come with a point of view, and the point of view is kind of like, we'd like you to do us what we want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're a lot better than they used to be, and there's some really good ones around here. So, but yours sounds like the classic hospital birth, which is, you know, if I could subtitle it, it's how to be a great patient.
Yeah. It was not good for me. I think that's that birth class. If I had just had a different birth class, I think it could have helped because I think I knew what I wanted. I didn't realize I had to fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
So did you not want to like look at any other types of classes, or you just after that one?
I just had no idea.
Class check. Checklist. Mm-hmm. Pack bag check.
Yep.
Did your OB recommend taking childbirth classes or anything like that? Or
I think it was one of the ones they recommended. Yeah.
7x7.
So
how does your labor start?
So my water breaks and we...
Where in relation to your due date?
I was 40 weeks, so...
You're like on your due date? You're the one?
Pretty much.
That doesn't surprise me already about you.
Why is that?
I don't know. You just seem like the technical writer. Oh, 40 weeks.
Yeah, I remember that day. I walked and walked. It must have been my due date because I walked and walked and walked and walked and walked, and I got my hair done and I got my nails done and I just kept walking, and then I got home and I was like, oh my God, I'm exhausted. And I laid down and just...
Gush of water.
Yeah.
No mistake.
So...
That's my water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Were you excited?
I was actually, when my water broke, I was a little nervous because I knew it fit into a smaller percentage of...
Oh, because you weren't having contractions yet?
Yeah.
Oh, so cerebrally, you knew this.
I knew it might not be a good thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it could be fine, but
yeah,
if you're already having contractions and your water breaks, we don't have to worry about what happens if your water breaks and you're not having, and your contractions don't come.
Right. Yeah.
So just a little more comforting the other way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Did your contractions not start?
They ended up starting naturally when we got to the hospital the next day.
24 hours later?
It was less, because I think we called the doctor to ask her what that meant. And she said, oh, don't worry, you know. And we said, well, is there any risk? And she said, well, there's always risk, you know, of infection. And she wasn't really giving us a straight answer of what we should do, because I wasn't in labor yet.
Mm-hmm.
And we were wondering if we should go to the hospital or not go to the hospital, and she didn't want to say either way.
Well, that's interesting. So you kind of left it up to you.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. But at the time, we were frustrated because we just wanted her to
input.
Be straight with yeah. us, you know?
Because you don't do this for a living.
Exactly.
As it turns out. So although now you might.
She just said, come at 6 a.m., so we set the alarm, which, you know, we shouldn't have done. We should have just slept until we woke up. And I didn't eat breakfast because I was so excited, which I should have done.
I eat double breakfast when I'm so excited. I envy people like you.
I'm also an eater. I'm like, oh, this looks great.
Happy.
So excited.
Or if I'm sad.
Me too.
Or just,
chocolate chip cookies.
Or just because I woke up.
Yeah.
So you skip breakfast because you're excited.
Yes, which I didn't realize, you know, you can't eat during labor. So we had packed stuff.
I'm sorry, is that a hospital policy?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
At your hospital?
Yeah. Yeah. So we had packed
most.
Yeah.
Depends on where.
And also it's changing. Like now sometimes you get ice chips or Jell-O.
Yes.
Or,
when I found out I couldn't have a drink of water, that I could only have ice.
You couldn't have water?
No. I could only, they said, well, you can have some ice chips. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Wow. That's not supported anymore by ACOG, is it?
I have no idea.
I think they're sure. Like clear fluids.
But I know Whittier is actually like that also.
No drinking?
Yeah. When I was there, I could only have ice chips.
My hospital also said no booze.
Really?
Is that ACOG? So you get there and you haven't eaten and now you can't.
Yeah.
And your water's broken almost a day.
Yeah.
So do they want to, what do you want to do and what do they want you to do?
So at that time, they were letting me see what happened. So I checked into a room. You know, they brought me up in a wheelchair, which I thought was funny because.
Because you weren't sick? Because you play tennis? Because you're
Well, I wasn't even athlete. In labor. So it was like taking a normal person.
Just a policy again, yeah. Right?
I was like, okay, sure, I'll take a ride.
Yeah.
And I remember watching the sunrise. It was really pretty, nice, you know. And I think we had a birth ball. We brought our birth ball. And I just was hanging out, and my contractions started. On their own, just like that, you know, just when they needed to start. And so everything was looking good.
How'd they feel?
Painful, super bad.
Tolerable?
Yeah, I mean, we videotaped the labor, and that's one of the reasons why I'm able to write so clearly about what happened. And one of the things when I watched it, I remember thinking, wow, I look so calm. But kind of like what you said before the recording, this recording was in my head, I was miserable. Mm. But when you look at me visually through the video, I'm just laying there.
Interesting.
You know, doing normal breathing, but I was just tormented in my head.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long did that go on for?
Oh, I mean, that was the whole time. It was hard for me. But, yeah.
But you made up your mind you wanted no drugs.
Right.
Did you start second guessing that at some point?
Yeah. So what happened was, I think the major thing that was difficult. Well, there was a lot of things that I remember feeling was annoying. One, just the nurses, different nurses, and a lot of vaginal exams. The vaginal exams were so painful, and they had you roll on your back, and it was, even now, I just can't, it's just so painful. And it was like, for, you know, a new nurse would come in, and then one would leave, and they'd chart. So if they came in, they'd vaginal exam, chart it. They left. Before they left, they'd chart. The new person would come in, check, like, maybe even 5 minutes later, right, because they're on duty. Check, note it, and then they would leave their shift. And it,
or, two things. First of all, are you at any point asking for them not to do that?
No. I didn't, you know, I just didn't know.
Policy,
I just,
so you're just going with it.
I just thought that, you know, that's normal. That's just normal. That's,
also, are you progressing?
Yeah, I'm progressing enough. And then one of the nurses says, oh, I started to push. And one of the nurses says to another nurse, and this was another thing that psychologically it's interesting about birth, at least for mine, was when people are talking about you when you're sitting right there, you know, you're kind of in your own world, of course, but you can hear what's going on. So a lot of times in this birth, people were talking about me, but not to me. So they're talking to each other like, oh, my God, she's pushing. Mm-hmm. And, oh, my God, she's pushing. And they check me and they, you know, claim I'm complete, call in someone else. And someone else says, oh, God, did you, you know, and then they start bickering like she's not complete. She's seven. And they're talking to themselves. And one is like training. So she's like talking to her about the training and, you know, it's, and I'm like sitting there listening, thinking, oh my God, I thought I was done and now I'm at seven.
And you're wanting to push.
And I'm wanting to push. And it's, I'm totally confused. And they are confused. And I kind of give up at that point. I think it went on for a little while. You know, I was like, I want the epidural because I was so mad that they were not,
like, you didn't have any,
they didn't
support
know
or
yeah
direction.
They didn't know what they were doing, it sounded like. So I'm like, I can't deal with this. Like, if you guys don't know what's going on, I need an epidural. And I remember when I got the epidural, I said, oh my God, that was the best decision I ever made. And I do still believe that was, even though it could have, you know, ultimately, you know, continued to lead to this cesarean in the end, at the time it was so amazing to just have your pain taken away like that. Mm-hmm. Instantly. It was a miracle.
I have to imagine that, you know, especially when you're done with it in your mind. You just, you know, I see some women who just, it's like tough mutter. They just love it, you know. It's intense. I'm not saying it's easy. It seems like the most intense thing, but they thrive on that intensity, the challenge and the adrenaline that comes with it. But then you sometimes see somebody who's totally done. And when you're done to turn off that pain, it looks like heaven. Like,
oh my God.
This is a gift from God. So how did that, because you said it turned into a cesarean, how did that turn into a cesarean and over what period of time?
Yeah, so the one interesting thing that I always think back to about the epidural was when I got on the epidural, everybody calmed down. They dimmed the lights. I got a warm blanket. They turned the fetal monitor around and my family came in and visited. And it was like the most peaceful experience. And I kept thinking,
why didn't we do this before?
Didn't we do this before?
Yeah.
And the nurses left. Like, it was just lovely. Hmm. And then they checked me periodically, let me sleep for a while, and then I was 10, I guess, for real. And then I had to push, and I couldn't feel. So before, I could feel the urge to push, so I knew what I was doing. And now they're like, push, and I was like, I don't feel like I need to push. But I was 10, and so you're being coached on how to push, like, can't remember how they were coaching me, but it was just impossible. I didn't feel like I was doing anything.
Were they able to shut it down, the epidural, or turn it down so you can feel more?
That wasn't proposed.
Not presented to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So
did they give you anything else other than an epidural? Like,
oh yeah, before the epidural, actually, they said, oh, before you, they were trying to actually not give me the epidural straight away because I was so close.
You were so close. You were 10 or 7 or 10 or whatever.
I was so close, but I was so upset at that point too. So they gave me fentanyl, and that was horrible.
In your IV.
It was horrible because it made the pain worse.
Why?
I just don't think I reacted well to the morphine. Oh. I started seeing, like, hallucinating and seeing rabbits and stuff in the lights.
Had a weird effect on you. No, because for most people, when I see them get it, it has a very calming and pain-relieving effect.
Yeah.
They usually fall asleep.
Oh. Yeah, no, it just heightened everything for me. So, actually, I even was demanding more. When the fentanyl started kicking in, I'm like, oh my God, you have to give me the epidural. And they're like, but you just took this. I'm like, I don't care. They're like, give it 20 minutes. I'm like, no.
No, it had the opposite effect on you.
Yeah, I'm seeing rabbits. It's really painful. So.
So, is it because you couldn't feel and mechanically push that you ended up?
Yeah, I mean, I pushed for 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
That was the limit. I know ACOG now recommends 4, which could have.
Oh, was that a hospital policy limit?
Yeah, 3 hours.
Oh, and then we call it, period?
Yeah, I mean, that's what it sounded like.
Did you know that, like,
no.
As the hours were going by?
No, I didn't know that at all.
So just at 3, they're like, sorry, we have to go now.
Well, what happened was the nurse said, it's 11:30. We should probably call the doctor in from, her house. And is that okay with you? Can I call the doctor in? And right now, looking back, I'm like, basically that's when I decided to have the cesarean, I didn't know
at the time
that meant basically I was having a cesarean. So the doctor was called in and she had me push one time and then just brought the paperwork and said, she rolled her stool up next to me and she said, it's time to get this baby out. You're fine. Your baby's fine. It's just time. And I just started crying. And I didn't know I could ask for more time. I didn't know that I could ask for a second opinion. I didn't know I could say no.
I'm guessing no doula.
Nobody, and I started to cry because I didn't want one.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I didn't know how.
Why didn't you want one? I mean, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have not wanted one. I'm just saying, what about it was?
I don't know. I just, looking back, I just knew I didn't want one, and so I was sad to give that give that hope up of having the vaginal birth. I had my mind set on having one of those. So
you strike me. I don't know. I'm just wondering. You strike me as competitive and athletic.
Yeah.
And this is sort of an athletic event.
And like a goal, right? Goal oriented, like not making your goal.
Yeah, I felt like I failed. I felt like a failure. And I've even asked Zach, which my husband, I was just like, what did I say? I said, I failed you. And I think what I was really saying is I failed myself. I asked him, I said, did I fail you? He started crying at that point. He's like, no, of course not. But in my mind, I hadn't even had this cesarean yet. I was getting prepped for it. Pubic hairs are being shaved. 7 people are in there doing stuff to you. You sign the paper and now really no one's asking you, for anything. They're just doing stuff. It was scary.
Thank you for sharing that so openly. I mean, It's, you know, we made a movie, I don't know if you've seen it, Trial of Labor.
Yeah.
And it's several women who had cesareans they didn't want, and many of them feel like they didn't need. And we follow them through their pregnancies, their second or sometimes third pregnancies, hoping for their first vaginal birth. It's hard to share it. And the reason they share their stories, and I'm sure the reason you're sharing yours, is to help other women. You know, in their case, they want to help people not fall into the pitfalls that they fell into. And it sounds the same for you, and sort of like how to have your second birth experience the first time around might be a little subtitle.
Yeah.
For your book. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I would like to hear more about how that cesarean experience was for you, because it obviously prompted a giant shift in your life, and to talk a little bit about your memoir, Second Chance. In the meantime, at home, we're going to take a little break from our sponsor, but if you don't already know, we have a new series coming out on YouTube. It's called The Real Midwives of Los Angeles. And you can find it at youtube.com/TheRealMidwives or TheRealMidwives.com. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash. Welcome back to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, and I am here with co-host Kristen Palese and our guest today, Thais Derich. She's the author of Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After a Cesarean. And before the break, you were talking about your first birth experience, which I think is not very uncommon. I know for myself, my generation, my parents pretty much, they grew up doing whatever the doctor tells you. And I think they grew up in a simpler time where doctors really didn't have that much pulling us in different directions. Our main goal was to help you and to sort of, if you were sick, help you feel better, get better. But in today's day and age, there's a lot more factors. I mean, there's insurance factors in terms of liability. And so liability is risk to a provider that may not be risk to a patient. And so I have to sort of defensively make choices that protect me, but they may not be in your best interest. And so that's one of many examples of how practitioners today are pulled in a lot of different directions. And so as patients today, we have to be much more active, much more aware, and take an active role in the decision making.
Absolutely.
What was your cesarean experience like? You started to talk about it. You didn't want it. You felt like you failed yourself and potentially your husband. You know, you're an athlete who pictured natural childbirth, even though you didn't really do that much homework to it. It just felt like what you're going to do because you got pregnant, you have a baby inside you, and you just bring it out. So there's sadness or a sense of letdown, but mechanically, what was the cesarean experience like for you?
It was horrible. I mean, from the very beginning, just going down, there was one, I guess, one OR, and it was open, so they really wanted to get there before someone else took it, because then we would have had to wait, which would have been really good for me, because I probably would have had my baby in the waiting time. But So they're rushing me, running me down the hall. And I just, it was so unnecessary to be so rushed like that.
More dramatic.
Yeah. And then my husband was running with me. And then we get to the doors and they ask him, tell him he can't go in. And I was like, what?
For the birth?
For the prepping
period. Oh, for the prep. Okay.
And, but that moment.
Not that that's okay, but right. I thought you were saying he couldn't even
birth.
Be present
yeah,
at the birth.
Yeah, no, the prep period. But it didn't matter at that point. That separation traumatized me. So I did hypnosis after the birth to figure out why I couldn't tell my birth story without bawling. Because finally, after a year, I'm like, okay, it's been a year. I should be able to be over this by now. That's kind of the second birth where it prompted me to figure out what was going on with me psychologically. And what I found out was it was that moment, one of the moments was that moment of separation, which links back to my abandonment by my mother. So him being separated from me at that moment triggered some trauma, dealt with.
Subconscious.
Yeah, subconscious trauma of separation. And also just going into the OR, I've never been sick. So I didn't know what to expect. It was scary. There was the doors looked like huge freezer doors and they were automatic. And, when they seal, they're like, it's scary.
Yeah.
And
And they took away your support.
Took away my support. Personally. So I was in there. I even asked the gurney man, can you please stay with me?
This part of the book that she writes about, I cried because I couldn't imagine like feeling lonely like that and alone. I know we're not talking about that yet, but it was just so, so sad.
So sad.
Yeah. And he said no.
And he said, no, I can't.
He couldn't stay, the gurney man.
So you have another
person. Another abandonment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk for a minute about your growing up? Because it's obviously played a very pivotal role here.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that came up with birth for me was my mom left her three children when I was small, around four. And
what number are you?
Right now?
No.
I'm like, I'm not telling you my age.
No. I would never.
In order of siblings?
Two. So in the middle.
You're the middle child.
Yes.
Oh, that's even better. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm the stuffing between the two pieces of bread, which is what my grandmother used to tell me. My dad is amazing. My stepmother is amazing. So I never really thought that I was hurt by that time in my life until birth. And I, for whatever reason, it bubbled up to the top and I had to deal with it. So... you know, it just kind of, I couldn't do anything but seek some help around my feelings, around my mom leaving me when I was young.
And then once you're prepped, what does prep mean? Like, at what point can your husband come back in? And what is the purpose of him not being there? Do you know? Did they tell you? No, it's just protocol.
Yeah.
I've heard that also, that, like, they have them leave or only one person can stay. I think that's becoming more of a practice. They'll allow one person, your support person, to stay. But
for prep?
Yeah, it wasn't common to let them.
I don't, even when they give an epidural, they like to kick everybody out.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I had to do that too.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the type of thing that just does so much psychological damage to women. The cesarean started. It was horrible. I was freaking out. I had the anesthesiologist behind me who was my saving grace. I would be like, I can't breathe. I thought I could feel them cutting me. I heard a saw sound.
Oh.
I thought they were using like instead of just a flat scalpel, I thought it was like a moving one, like a chainsaw. So I had these images going on in my brain that weren't helping me. And so he would give me a shot of something and I'd sink, you know, and then come back up and I'd say, what happened? Is the baby here? And I'm just looking in my husband's eyes and I can just tell how upsetting it is by just looking at, he's, you know, it's hard for him too, you know? And so I'm, yeah. And, you know, so the baby comes out and, you know, the book has this whole thing in great detail. So, but the baby comes out and he's big and healthy and they dangle him over me and they never let me hold him. And then he's off being washed and weighed and, you know, all the shots. No one's asking me any of the, you know, if I want any of this. Nothing's wrong with him, right? So, but I never get to hold him. And then they take him off to the nursery. Still haven't held him. And they wheel me into a closet for, they call it the recovery room, maybe, or recovery closet. I don't really know. I recently interviewed an OB in Marin, and I was telling her my birth story, and she's like, oh, I know that closet. I'm like, they're still using the closet.
Oh, wow.
And she's like, they're still using the closet. I'm like, we need to get rid of the closet, you know, because this was another thing that came up in hypnosis was being alone in a closet while I...
While someone was doing inventory. That's,
right. I woke up to, there was a nurse in there, but she was stacking boxes, like opening cardboard boxes and putting stuff in shelves.
It's really a closet?
It's really a closet.
I'm just like saying like it was so small, it was a closet.
No, there was stuff in there.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And so I came to and I was like, where's my baby? You know, it's just like, where's my baby? Where's my baby? And she's like, oh, do you want to hold your baby? And I'm like, yes, I want to hold my baby. So I finally get the baby. And yeah.
Did you feel bonded, connected,
excited?
Yeah, I felt
good. I unwrapped. So one thing my sister said, and I remembered her saying this, was she's like, yeah, they delivered my baby all swaddled up and tight. And I unwrapped the baby and, you know, held the baby naked. So that was one thing I learned from her was I received the baby all tightly swaddled.
Bundled.
And I unwrapped my baby.
Shame on you.
And, like, looked at it and, you know, breastfed right away. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, that was pretty
nice. What was the
nice.
Physical recovery like?
Horrible. I mean, it was painful to walk. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I never wanted to leave the hospital. Breastfeeding was really painful. And then the part that was really difficult and surprising to me was how I think I felt pain for 2 years afterwards.
At the incision area? Or?
Yeah, like all, you know, around that area. When I got my period, the pain was new, the pain I'd get. And I called it my phantom pain because I couldn't believe I was still in pain because everybody told me cesareans were easy and everybody was having cesareans and that it's...
But for some women, they seem to be.
Yeah, maybe for some people it's easy. I don't know. But for me, it was...
I also wonder if it's something you want, if it might be easier.
Yeah, so
or
that's...
Or something that you prepare for more. Like
exactly. It's... That's why I called it my phantom pain. Was I wasn't sure if it was pain from the trauma or real
or both.
Physical pain or a little both. What I determined was I think it was just my period had changed. So, 'cause the pain would shift from side to side. So I could tell it was with the, you know, the ovaries on different sides. And I don't really know. So,
well, this totally shifted your whole life.
Yes.
You mentioned that after this, you struggled a little, and then you also struggled with childcare, and you stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
Not to fast forward too far, but how far apart are your kids? They're
3 years.
3 years
yeah.
apart. Did it take you a while to feel ready to try again?
Yeah. Well, again, I had that drive. You know, I wanted to have another kid, and I knew I didn't want just one child. So, but then I was like, I know I don't want to do that again. And my life started opening up. I think the universe kind of noticed it was giving me a second chance. So I met a friend who was a birth advocate, and she had a blog, and she would kind of, you know, she believed me. So a lot of, you know, one thing is when you tell people you're traumatized by their birth, people don't want to hear that, you know, because if we admit that we're traumatizing women in the hospital, like if we all agree to that, that crumbles everything. Mm-hmm. The system is gone because we're admitting that we're doing something wrong. And so nobody wants to look at that. And I felt that, and it was hard to recover because nobody believed me or nobody took me seriously. And so I found
that the experience that, was traumatic, yeah. That it left you traumatized.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I should add is I went in afterwards and did and asked like what I could have done to avoid the cesarean, and I was told I could have just pushed longer. So
at the hospital, yeah. Your team told you that? Mm-hmm. But you didn't know that was a choice in the moment.
No.
How was your second pregnancy?
So the second pregnancy was good, and I was doing all this healing, and I found a women's circle, and I was going to chiropractic, and I was doing meditation.
Acupuncture.
I was like, you know, I saw Business of Being Porn, and I was like reading everything. I was reading.
Totally different from your first.
Totally different.
Sounds like 180.
I was like, oh, I guess I need to put some effort in here.
Yeah. Was your hospital supportive of VBAC or, I mean, quote unquote, allow VBAC or?
Well, when I knew I wasn't going to go back to the same practice.
Oh,
so
did you find another magazine?
Nope. I moved on from that. I knew this was a big deal. And when, you know, I was doing all the reading and I realized that what was happening wasn't evidence-based and I was reading the studies myself and wondering why my doctors weren't reading the same studies. So it was confusing and I felt betrayed and I felt confused at how this could be happening. And this is kind of why I wrote a book about it. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. It's upsetting that it's still happening in most cases.
With all that info,
I just started interviewing and I had questions I wanted to ask. And I knew right away because, one, just getting an interview with an OB, I mean, that's pretty hard. So already there was a hospital that didn't even do interviews. So I could cross out a whole hospital just by not being able to meet who was going to be my team. And then there was people that I could tell right away said, yes, you can try for a VBAC, but you have to have this and you have to have that, you know. And I was like, well, and then I'd push back and they would relent. But then they would say more restrictions, so or different restrictions, you know. And I just wasn't feeling, I'm like, you know, this doesn't really feel, it feels like a battle. It doesn't feel like, yay, Theis, so happy you want to be back. Let's work on this. We're all going to do it together. You can do it. You know, we'll be there to keep you safe. It was like, oh, you want to do that? Okay, we're going to make it as hard as possible, and you're probably going to end up in a C-section in any way. So we'll let you try, but we're going to have the OR ready, you know?
Yeah, even that name, trial of labor.
Yeah.
You give it a shot.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it impossible. And so I realized that I couldn't even give birth in a hospital because if I really wanted to do this, I wasn't going to get the support I needed in the hospital.
Did you have another choice?
So I had to look into home birth, and I didn't even know home birth existed before. And so proposing that to my husband and to my family was kind of just very, you know, crazy. Like,
crazy to you or crazy to them?
Crazy to them and crazy to me too. Like, I had to keep, through the whole pregnancy, I had to keep reminding myself why I was doing this because nobody else supported me. You know, my husband got on board and supported me and was, you know, amazing in that because, you know, he was along, I was having this huge, it wasn't just the birth, I was having this huge personal growth period. And he was just like, whoa, my wife, she's changed.
Yeah.
And
scary.
How was that for you guys and also having a small child?
I mean, we were good. We made it through, and it was a good period for me.
And the midwives in your area, they do VBAC or HVAC, I guess?
Yeah, so there was one that said, sorry, I don't do that, which is fine. You know, everybody has their comfort level. But it did shock me because I was making this huge leap to even consider a home birth. And my first phone call was, and I'm also, arguing with everybody about, no, it's safe, actually. And then a midwife tells me she doesn't do.
She doesn't think it's safe.
She doesn't think it's safe. And I'm like, oh, God. So I had to go. I kept going back to the research. And so I found Maria Iarella, who's amazing and has, delivered well over 1,000 births. And
you're doing this research all while you're already pregnant?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
At what point did you start with her in your pregnancy?
Pretty early on. Okay. Yeah.
So you have a totally different, your visits are more midwific and your preparation's more midwific.
Yeah.
I mean, you write about this in the book, but I want to also talk about the development of the book, so I don't mean to fast forward too far, but how does your second birth go?
So the second birth is beautiful.
How does it start?
It starts, so I call my second baby my 9-to-5 baby, because it starts with contractions early morning. I meditate for like 3 hours. We call the doula. She comes.
It starts with contractions, not your water breaking.
Right.
So you're already off on a different path.
Yeah. Because I think, what do you take when you want to make your...
Castor oil?
No, when you want to make your water bag strong.
Oh, stronger?
Is it grapefruit? Yes, I was doing the grapefruit stuff.
I'm sorry, that's really
loud. It might have worked because my water didn't break.
Yeah.
So, it was great. I had doula and, I was going through and it was good and it got hard. And the main thing with Maria was I said, the biggest thing is uterine rupture. So I don't, I'm not here. I'm not, I don't want to die at home. But so I want you to make sure that at any sign that you see this going out of the normal spectrum that I go to the hospital.
Yeah, just to fill in that information, uterine rupture is the risk of doing a vaginal birth after a cesarean, right? It's the concern that that scar, that incision that was made into your uterus, maybe during the heat of labor will become so weak that it separates and the baby's not fully contained anymore inside your uterus. So I think uterine rupture is probably not only a terrible term, but not all that accurate for what normally happens. But it's, you don't want to do dangerous things. You just want a different experience and a more supported experience in a more nurturing environment. But your midwife, you made it clear if you see signs that things are, there's a pink flag, I'd rather not wait at home and see if that becomes a red flag.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really trusted her and I had a lot of great support team and I got to a point where I was stuck, kind of the same spot where I was stuck with the first baby. And I remember asking her, am I going to be able to do this?
Stuck meaning you're pushing now for a while
and
the baby's not coming down?
Well, they want you to go 1 centimeter an hour.
Oh, you're stuck on the curve.
Yeah. So I stopped progressing. And I remember asking that. And she said, well, Thais, you have to be complete to push this baby out. And I just loved how she was not trying to be nice to me, She was just like, well, this is the fact here.
Yeah.
Like,
no sugarcoating.
You need
to get there.
And so, and that for me, like, I think as an athlete, I was like, fine, I am going to get there. And I just, from then on, I just became complete. She did massage a little bit of the cervix away. And then the baby came pretty fast. afterwards.
You were on land, or were you in water?
I was on land, yeah.
Did you want to be on land, or you weren't sure?
I was asked if I wanted to go back in the water, and I wasn't. I think the thought of walking back to the first
tub. Yeah, it was too much.
Yeah. So it was great, you know. And
certainly different.
So different.
And where did you choose in your home, too?
I was on my bed.
Okay.
Yeah. It was pretty funny because we have all white sheets. And when she did her walkthrough, Maria was like, do you have any other color?
Yeah. Our midwife for our home birth said to go to the 99-cent store and see if we can find some linen. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
She didn't tell me, though, to put a towel next to the tub because my wife did give birth in water. And that would have been very helpful because that step out of the tub with all the gooey, you know, stuff. And my kids were all sleeping, but then it was getting later. They were going to wake up, and I went into the bathroom. I was like, crime scene. It looked like a crime scene. So I was, my midwife was like, you got to get hydrogen peroxide and a toothbrush. And so that's, you know, my brand new baby, and my wife's cuddling him, and I'm on the floor with the grout.
Scrubbing away.
Yeah, scrubbing away. I did a good job. But that one piece of information
would have been helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing that you had this journey and that you clearly feel passionately that you know other people are having the same, falling into the same pitfalls and being pushed into the same outcomes. And so you wrote the book, Second Chance, and it's a good book. And I think it's going to help your mission to alert others and to try to help change the system. You've been doing some book touring. What is the response that you get to it?
I am really encouraged. I'll tell you just the story that comes up in my mind whenever I'm asked this question. There was a 70-year-old woman in the audience. So you take questions at the end, and she's whenever people read my book and whenever I talk to them, the first reaction is they want to tell me their birth story. And so I wasn't surprised when she started telling her birth story. But what she said was, she's like, she just was like, I'm so happy you're saying this out loud because I still feel upset about my birth. And she's 70.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, you know, break the wall of, oh, it's fine, I have a healthy baby, like everything's fine, and we start really telling the truth, you start to hear the truth back. And there's so many people who have had hard experiences that I just feel like we really need to fix this, because I think that the pain is just, we keep making the pain over and over again when we know the answers. The evidence is there. The studies are there. If the studies aren't there, we need to invest in women and take this seriously and do the studies to get everybody on the same page so we stop hurting women. We shouldn't walk out of the hospital traumatized. We should walk out feeling empowered and
Wonder Woman,
beautiful and strong. And
that's what you see sometimes. Yeah. After, I mean, that's, I imagine how you felt after your second one.
Yeah, and I think that's what prompted the book again. Was I was just like, wow, I could have this horrible cesarean experience, or I could have this amazing, transformative, empowering moment that changed my life, where you feel literally, when you're pushing a baby out, you're as close to God as you can get, you know. There, you're not in control. Something else is happening to you.
Jesus,
you know?
Take the wheel.
Exactly.
I would just also say that I think you can have equally traumatic experiences that aren't cesarean.
Absolutely. You know,
I think a lot of your first experience wasn't necessarily the cesarean, but everything that led up to it as well. And I also think that it's important to note that I think cesareans are a great thing,
mm-hmm.
for people who need them, certainly, and for people who want them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it would be equally awful for someone who needed to have a cesarean not have access to it.
Absolutely.
So it's the system and how we're approaching birth in general that needs some fixing up and mm-hmm. some tuning.
Yeah.
And I think that strong and courageous women like you who come back from that experience and share openly and then take a megaphone, whether mm-hmm. it's a book or a book tour or this decade, keynote speaking,
yeah.
podcasting, and yeah. Shouting off the rooftops until people listen to you is going to change the system. I think you're going to make big changes.
Thank you. I sure hope so.
I think you do it really well also, because it's like when you read the book, it's not even, I don't feel like, oh, it's because of this. It's just the fact that you, and I feel like what this podcast is all about, being informed. Mm-hmm. It's that you didn't feel like you had these people who you felt were supposed to have your best interest, whether or not you have a birth plan or you don't, but you just didn't feel like they had your back. You know, mm-hmm. and you felt like they were just making decisions based on things that were motivating them rather than making sure you were having a good experience or that you were understanding just even what was happening to you at
yeah.
the time.
I think the main thing, there was no connection.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, part of it was my fault, too, because I didn't do anything, you know, but that's how a lot of people are when they go into childbirth. So what that needs to happen is there needs to be, yeah, like a coach.
You're a strong woman. You didn't do anything because the system set you yeah. up to be disempowered.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't really think it's your fault.
Yeah. Or any woman's fault, really, because, yeah. I mean, it's your first time. It's mm-hmm. not like, I think that's what's so scary sometimes about birth is that when it's your first time, you don't know. Like, you don't know what a contraction is going to feel like. You mm-hmm. don't know what's going to happen to your body, how you're going to react, how you're going to feel.
Yeah.
So if you don't know any of that, how would you know how to prepare for it? The yeah. second time you can get the information, you seek out whatever happened right. to you that you wished you could have done differently,
exactly.
like hindsight 2020, right?
Yeah, that's so well put. Yeah. And that's the hard thing with the first cesarean, you know, because then it makes it even harder the next time to have a natural birth if that's what you want, you know. 44% of hospitals are banning vaginal birth after cesarean, and so your women are actually being forced into C-section. And so now we get into this whole human rights issue, women's rights issue, where we're forcing women into interventions that they don't want because there's just no one to provide them with what they want.
Where can we find you online and get more information and just follow your journey as it continues?
Yeah, so I'm pretty active on social media, so Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and then I have a website, which is my first and last name, T.
Faye Sterich.
Yes.
How do we spell that?
THAISDERICH.com.
Okay, we'll check it out. I really want to thank you again for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen, for joining me and for all your work and breaking this book apart and analyzing it and getting all the juicy details out of it. For our listeners, thank you for listening. And you can find more information at informpregnancy.com. And if you have any questions, always feel free to write to us, info@informpregnancy.com. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby. Not even diaper rash.